Daniels, which used to hide all over my house around here. So he's a neighbor of those facilities down there. He's a sponsor. He's a sponsee. He even does this during the middle of ice storms, and he goes to his home group is the Diggs Group, in Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm very excited to hear his story tonight. And his name is Mike L., straight from Louisville, Kentucky. If we could give him a warm Valley Group welcome, that would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, thank you very much. My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic, and I really, to be correct, I should say I finally accepted the gift of sobriety on September 7th of 1985. It had been first offered to me in somewhere back in the March of 1979, but I was an alcoholic of the resistant variety. Congratulations to all those people that are celebrating birthdays tonight. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I was talking with an old timer in my home group in Gary's 56 years sober now. And when I met Gary, I was getting a 90-day token, and he was getting a 21-year chip. And all the single girls, and I assume some of the married ones, thought he was gorgeous, and I hated him right on the spot for that. And all these many years were together. Well, part of my problem was my married girlfriend thought he was cute. I don't have a conventional path in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to show you probably as much qualification as you need to see. I'm going to turn off my screen for a second and show you a real picture of what my family claims this was me the first time they said no and made it stick. So that's the personality I acquired. I hadn't had a drink yet, but you can see that kid definitely needed something, and it was there. I grew up in a college town in the Midwest, Iowa City, Iowa, home of the Big Ten University. And when I grew up there in the 50s, it was a town of about 50,000 permanent residents and about 25,000 more students at the university. And, as my born on third base and wanted credit for hitting a triple. I had sober parents that remained married all their lives. I was the first of four children, the beloved little prince, and all of that. We lived next door to the mayor. What were you going to do? There wasn't anything to complain about. I don't know if we were a normal family, but I would say we were a functional family, because when troubles came around, the family, my parents and later on my younger sibling, they all faced up to that stuff. I was frequently the source of what was going on there. And a big piece of my amends to that family and those siblings was simply that their big brother just kind of sucked the oxygen out of the room. When there were things that should have been happening for them, it was, oh, my God, Mike's got this going. Mike's got that. It was the Mike story. And That was exceedingly unfair to them. I was a suck up as a kid. I looked for approval from adults was my first source of power. So I volunteered for everything possible at school. I worked in the principal's office, joined all the correct groups, and got good grades, because it seemed to... Well, let me tell you like this. One of my friends made the mistake of asking me over for dinner one night. And we had dinner, and when dinner was over, I jumped up from the table and started grabbing plates and carrying them into the kitchen and rinsing them off. And pretty soon, Bill's mom came in and said, "Hey, Bill, why can't you be like that nice Lorenz boy?" And I got that little, I don't know, it felt good. When I was 11 years old, I stumbled across the first bit of alcohol that was significant to me. I had enough that I got the effect. And although I didn't become a daily drinker at 11, that took another year or two, all of a sudden there began to be like a demon possession in our house. And my parents are looking at each other, wondering what happened to the honor student? What happened to the kid that wanted to please all the adults? What happened to that kid? Because now I found what I need, and this is my attitude toward the world. And a couple stories kind of maybe you can decide whether I was an alcoholic drinker or not. I'm just barely 16. I got my driver's license, and this is the area around the town I grew up in. It's rural, so I've got my car. I've got a few six packs, and I've got my buddy with me, and we're riding around out in the country, talking about girls and drinking beer and telling each other lies about everything. And all of a sudden, the red light goes on behind me. And it was just one of the old gumball machines. It wasn't a light bar like we got today. And I turned to my friend and I said, "Watch this." And I just eased the car off to the side of the road. Put it in neutral, put on the brake, and got out. And I started walking back toward that police car. It was a sheriff's car, actually. Sheriff's deputy had pulled me over. And small town. He knows me. He knows my parents. I know him. And so I'm smiling and waving like this, and I'm walking back to Barney Fife, and as he was a little slower getting out of his car, because he was a little fatter, kind of like I am now, and when I got there to his car a little quicker than he did, and so I, when he got out of that car, I grabbed him and slammed him down across the hood of that patrol car and took his gun away from him. And then I laughed and handed it back to him. And if he was mad when I took it, he was really pissed when I gave it back to him. And he was sputtering and cussing and everything else. But finally, at the end of it, he took my beer and poured it out and told me to get the hell out of there. He didn't want to see me anymore that night. The most important part of this was my friend's watching out the back window, and he sees all this go down. So that story's all over my high school the next day. And I don't know why, but if you don't think you're much, you know, you can use a little street cred. And Lorenz taking the cop's gun away was a little street cred then. See, I've always been a little too smart for my own good. One time I was at an event and I was speaking with the late, great Frank Jones from out your way. And he wasn't the guy in that patrol car. You'd have another speaker tonight. Frank didn't think much of that. But that was... So this is what the period of time that I thought was my normal drinking. I would have told you when I finally got sober. There were other stories that occurred. I thought I was unjustly treated because my dad didn't get me the Corvette I thought I deserved, and he bought my mom a new car. And so when I got that car, I talked my mom out of it for a date. Ended up getting loaded with a bunch of my friends, and we were down at one of the guys, his dad owned a machine shop. We were out down drinking at Buck's machine shop, and maybe some of you had some friends like this. Jerry just lit a cutting torch and put it in my hand. He says, well, you know, you can't have a Corvette, but you could have a convertible here. So I proceeded to cut the top off my mother's new car. And Sunday morning, when my parents brought my younger siblings out in the garage to take them to church, there was kind of the smoking hulk of Mom's car with Big Brother laid out naked across the front seat. And all I remember is my mother yelling at my dad, Art, don't hit him. Please don't hit him. And I pushed on them real hard. So this was it, and I really thought those were all cute stories for a lot of time, long time, until I was telling some of them to a man named Don from Colorado, and Don pointed out to me that I was effectively a terrorist. You know, your so-called social drinking involved stealing, theft, distorted, take all this stuff, and you somehow think that's normal. What you know, does that sound right to you? And I'd never looked at it that way, because I'd always played a lot of my crazy, aberrant behavior for laughs. So fast forward here a bit. I was in college. I, again, still too smart for my own good. And so in 1966, I went on spring break down to Florida, and I was having such a good time, I decided I didn't need to come back and take my midterms. That was a big mistake, because the Army with the draft notice was waiting for me, and not long after I came back, and found myself in Vietnam. Had a whole bunch of experiences there, and oddly enough, for the rep of the Vietnam gets, it was probably my largest period of sobriety prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I found out quickly my job was as a platoon leader, taking guys through the Mekong Delta, through jungles and swamps and whatnot, and you can't do that and walk through booby traps and be met. If you want to understand what peer pressure is really like, try doing it loaded, because all those people around you are armed, and they're not going to let you mess up their lives. But the minute I got back, I started partying again. Fell upstairs for a while, got a business career, made more money than I knew what to do with. That'll lead to a bunch of white snow outside issues. I only need to work 8 months a year so I can hang out in Aspen and here and there and play the game and act like I'm some kind of a big deal, but I'm not. All this through alcoholism, crashes and burns, but those outside issues. But the reason I'm really comfortable identifying as an alcoholic is when money went away, when the stuff went away, I wasn't willing to do what it took to keep up those habits. Those were areas where, although it was difficult, I had a choice. Where I had no choice was with my alcohol. I ended up living with a gal, living off her is the truth, and we both pretended that someday I was going to hit it and be back in the big time again. But I think we both secretly knew that wasn't going to happen. I had the interview for the job that was going to fix it all. Company I'd wanted to work for years, and they flew me into New York for the interview, and I never got out of LaGuardia because I stopped at the bar to have a drink and relax before I took a cab downtown for the interview. And the time for the interview passed, and I turned around and just got back on the airplane and went home. Didn't even show for the interview. I learned about one day at a time living this way, because it's about the only way you can live when you're like that. The gal I was living with, she'd get up and go to work, and I'd get up whenever I could get up, and I'd make myself a drink and carry it into the bathroom in that apartment and sit on the edge of the tub by the toilet and try and get the first drink to say yeah, because there wasn't going to be any getting dressed or do anything else before that first drink stuck. And everything is pull over or slip on by this time, because tying things isn't part of the game yet. And when she'd come home, she'd take, I didn't know this at the time, she told me later, she'd take all the money out of her purse except what she was going to let me steal that night, and she'd put it under the carpet in the trunk of her car, and she'd come on in, and we'd have a little something to eat, watch TV show, and pretend we had a relationship. And then she'd go to bed, I'd be in her purse, out the back door, and down to the tavern with my buddies, one day at a time. And one day I'm on the floor in that bathroom, and all I can tell you is it must have been a wind of grace that had blown in there that day, because I had no reason to believe that I could get sober. I told you I started coming in March of 1979, and I remember the first speaker meeting, and the first meeting, and it was a speaker meeting I went to, and the guy was talking, and I thought, holy, I loved everything I heard. And then he dropped the God thing. Oh, no, not that. And not because I was really that antagonistic, I pretended I was, but the other thing about my young life is I was a guy that my parents weren't particularly religious, but I would beg my grandmothers to take me to church. Grandma, can I go to Mass with you? Grandma, can I go? All this kind of stuff, until I found alcohol. I was initially attracted to a spiritual way of living. I liked spiritual people. But I got to give something up. And any faith I had or thought I had had to be tossed in the wastebasket along the way. So I knew, okay, well, If it's a God thing, there's not going to be much help for me here. And I stumbled in and out of expensive treatment centers and less expensive. Finally, I'm in a veterans home, and I got a wonderful 12-step call there. A little orderly in gray scrubs came in. They actually put me in a hospital room because I was in bad shape. And the little orderly came in with a clipboard and his pen. He says, "Mister, they tell me there's a good chance you're not going to make it. Where do you want your effects sent?" No, oh man, you got to do it this time. You got to really, no, nothing. The man just told me the straight off truth. I was on my way out. Where did I want my little paper bag of stuff to go? Spiritual awakening then. See, for me, I was looking for spiritual awakenings in terms of burning bushes, and I guess those are fine. But the man who saved my life told me that anytime any alcoholic understands any part of the truth, a spiritual awakening has occurred. It's a miracle. I wasn't in the place I was because of what I didn't know, and I wasn't in the... I had education, I'd had money, I'd had advantages, I'd had medical treatment, I'd had all therapy. I had it all. But it just, I was impervious to it. It just rolled off. And that little orderly with his clipboard pierced that. You're full of crap and you're going to be dead real soon. The guy who thought he was so sophisticated and such a, I'm on my knees by a bunk there the next night because I couldn't get out of that bed. They had me hooked up to IVs. I'm on my knees by an old army cot in this room they put me in, and I'm down there and I can't remember anything. I've got blender brain, and I simply, the guy who thought he was such a hot shot, it's now I lay me down to sleep. And that little prayer was all that came to me, all I could remember. But, you know, as our book says, God doesn't make hard turns. So eventually, very quickly, I made the decision of what I'd never done before. Anonymous. I'm a smart guy. I'm going to come by. I'm going to find out what the tips are, what I need to know, and then I'm going to do what I want to do. I mean, one of those first treatment centers I was carried a legal pad, and I took notes, and you know, they were most of the counselors were very impressed with that, and the one guy came up and he nailed me. He says, man, he says, you really don't get it, do you? And I said, what do you mean I don't get it? I got it. What do you want to know? I got it all. And he says, no. He says, you're not a consultant here. You're a patient. And one more time, somebody had saved my life by calling money on me.
Looks like the camera is going away from me here. Let me...
There we go. I'll duck into it. So anyway, I get out of here and I go back and I work my way back to Indianapolis, and I end up at where all the hot shots do. I end up in his basement in my old room, and except thing, my youngest brother's become a wine distributor. He still is one. He doesn't have our affliction. He probably needs Al-Anon. Steve, my old bedroom is Steve's first warehouse. So my first night out of treatment center, they got to take the cases of wine and push them back against the wall so they're cases of wine a couple deep and all the way to the ceiling on three sides of me with a rollaway bed in there. But see, I'm safe and protected because that's the power of surrender. I made it home and I started going crazy about AA. I mean, you know, I'm going to 11 meetings a week because that's what you could do there then. And home groups, this and that and the other thing. It's another version full of BS because, I'm a slogan slinger. Hey, you got to just turn that over, man. You know, and if you backed me in the corner and said, well, Mike, just how the hell are you going to go about turning that over? I couldn't have told you. And there's a gal who's 5 years ahead of me that was a young mother at the time, and she came in because her soon-to-be ex-husband had come by her apartment where she and four kids were and terrorized them all with a shotgun, and she was pretty upset and in tears, and I'm so clueless, I told her she needed to do more service work. That would help her. Every year on her anniversary, she makes sure to get in touch with me and remind me how lucky I am that she didn't take me out right then and there. So the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, even at that level, happened. Oh, I did forget. I started to mention at the beginning, I deal here where I got fired by my sponsor, first sponsor, when I'm 2 years sober. Because I'm having an affair with a married woman in the program. I'm sponsoring her 16-year-old son, and I play euchre on the weekends with her husband. And her husband happens to be a gun-toting federal agent. So my new drug is drama and anxiety. You know, I'm Captain Sabahoe, don't you? And George grabbed me in the parking lot outside the Alano Club there, and he says, Mike, every time I confront you about your behavior, you explain it to me in such a way that I think, well, maybe it could be God's will. I know that's insane, so I can't have anything to do with you. And I heard that. I've wanted to airbrush that out of my story for a long time, but I was told I had to keep it in because it was part of the way I made amends, because other people are going to be making mistakes like that. And you need to know that my experience is I had to change my behavior, but I didn't have to get drunk over that. And so 5 years, I got a new career. I'm living in the cul-de-sac. I'm married to my first sober wife. Got a year-and-a-half-old stepson. I'm having life is wonderful. I mean, you know, I'm a poster boy. And as I come up on my fifth anniversary, I'm more desperate, more suicidal than I've ever been. I'm thinking of ways that I can kill myself so it won't embarrass the people I sponsor, you know, like I care. Further from a drink than I ever imagined I could be, the reason I'm so desperate is because told me all my life, and I bought the thing, is that, Mike, if you just didn't drink, you'd be one of our best students. Mike, if you just didn't drink, I'd keep this engagement ring. Mike, if you just didn't drink, we'd put you in senior management in this company. Mike, if you just didn't drink, fill in the blank. And now Mike hasn't had a drink for 5 years. But I did approximately what I did when I went to the University of Iowa years before. I went to the field house. I signed up for all my classes, went to the bookstore, bought all my books, threw the books in the closet, joined a fraternity, and started partying. And if you ran into me on campus and asked me what I was doing, I'd say, well, sir, I'm a pre-law student here at the University of Iowa. Well, that was technically true, except I was almost never in class. In an AA, I never missed a roundup. I never missed a dance. I never missed a meeting. I didn't miss a service commitment. I just missed the program. I talked about the program, but I wasn't living it and doing it. And so that guy Gary and I ended up running through a whole series of circumstances. I actually start having an experience with our big book in the Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, not as things to discuss and evaluate, but things, principles put in place in my life. The miracles have rolled on. I like newcomers. They're okay. But my real passion is when I get to go places and talk, I'm looking for that face of hopelessness out there among some guy who's got 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And the miracle has left him. And they're all around. Almost every place I go, tell me the story about the local guy with a lot of time, or the local gal, that they didn't drink again. They just put their car in the garage and let it run. They just drove off the road into a bridge abutment. You named what it was. Because they know drinking isn't going to help. It's just going to increase the pain. And apparently being sober doesn't work, because look at all the pain I'm in. And that's where I was. And so many miracles have happened since then. I'll just kind of... out of time just about, but I want to tell you about the last one. I've been a really part of my rotten past in back when I was in college. I had a college sweetheart that I loved like a rainbow, and I didn't just love her. I loved her family. Her brothers were hunting and fishing buddies. I liked her dad. I liked her mom, couple sisters, and this piece of inventory will tell you properly, as concisely as anything, where I was. Her name was Ellen. Where was I selfish? Well, I wanted to enjoy sex with her regardless of the consequences. I was dishonest. I told her not to worry. I'd always be there for her, no matter what. I dishonestly refused to consider my ability and willingness to keep that promise. Inconsiderate. I gave scant consideration to the consequences of my behavior to her, her family, her faith, her reputation, and her career. I aroused jealousy. I told her if she didn't have sex with me, I'd get it elsewhere. Isn't that wonderful? I paid undue attention to other women in her presence and let her know how attractive I found them. Aroused suspicion. I often spent time alone with other women. She found me at Holly's apartment. Bad day. Bitterness. I eventually wore her down, of course. And when she became pregnant, I told her I doubted it was my child. I told her mother I was too young to get married and didn't want to marry her anyway. And when she was in California having our baby, I made drunken calls to ring her. There wasn't any way to DM her then, or text message her, or anything else. I abandoned her and our child, and I blamed her for deserting me. And it goes on. One of the first benefits out here is I got an ideal for my future conduct here. If God would change, I can't change me, but if God was going to change me, what would I want it to look like? And I think for me, this was a spiritual awakening here. It says, I should have treated sex as a safe, sacred gift that it is. I shouldn't have engaged in behavior I wasn't willing to be responsible for. I should have honestly faced the consequences of my action. I should have been honest with myself and others. My harms were all rooted in dishonesty, particularly about how afraid I was. And then here was the thought of self-reliance will always produce fear and pain. Nasty stuff. And there was no amend to be made there, because when I saw her after she came back from California, and having that baby, she just cat traffic cop and said, that please, please, please stay away. Don't hurt me or my family anymore. And understandably so, and I honored that all these years. And see, if you think everything's happened to you that's going to happen to you, you're sober forever or whatever and all this, and you've done work, you've made all the amends you can and everything else. Well, I'm sitting in my oncologist waiting room here a couple of years ago, actually in March of 2018, and my phone chirped and I got an email on it. And here's the email. It says, "Hello, Mike. Your brother, Robert Lorenz, gave me your email address and said that you might be able to assist me. I'm fairly new to Ancestry.com and due to the search for my biological family. Ancestry matched Robert and I as having a close family DNA relationship. So far, this is the only close match for me." And she mentions that he's predicted to be her grandfather or uncle. She goes on, she says, "I'm a 47-year-old. My parents adopted me from Catholic Charities out of Sacramento, California. I was born in February of 1971. I have a family tree started, but it's all from my wonderful adoptive family. I'm curious to learn more about my biological family tree, and I would appreciate any information you might have. I would also like to say that I've had a good life and a loving adoptive family. I'm happily married and have one amazing 13-year-old daughter, and I'm grateful to my biological parents for making what I'm sure was not an easy choice in ensuring that I've had a good life. I'm curious about my biological roots and relevant medical history. I'd like to be able to provide that to my daughter for her benefit. I want to be sensitive to the fact that the story of my birth may not be known or shared, and I do not want to cause my biological parents and their families any distress. Thank you again for your assistance. Best regards, Joey," and then it gives her last name. Bang. There it is. And here's the thing. This was a Wednesday when I'm sitting in the doctor's office in the waiting room getting this. That Friday morning, I'm getting on a plane and I'm flying to Sacramento to do a retreat out there about 15 miles from her house. Doesn't God have a way of showing up at the right time? And Joey and I got in contact and we did a little more. I did some DNA stuff and we verified what we were pretty sure of, that I am her father. And then I got a chance to make amends because she, of course, wanted to lose my mom. And I said, "Well, I got some confidentiality problems there," but I reached out to her mom, and her mom got back to me and said, "Go ahead and give her the information," and I did. And so those two connected in 2018, and I've been out there a number of, I didn't get to see her on the first visit, but for some reason, while we were still talking in person, I was going to the spring flying in San Ramon, NCAA, whatever, and I've had a lot of opportunities to be out there. She lives in Roseville, just outside of Sacramento. And, God, the worst thing I've ever done in my life gets turned into something beautiful. Because she and I like and love each other. I'm just nuts for my granddaughter. I even like my son-in-law. And, you know, we've had wonderful time together. And I got to finally make those amends one-on-one to Ellen. And when I made them to her, she said, you're an AA, aren't you? She says, what you don't know is I've got my son, her son, Ellen's son, she says, for 9 years in AA, and I sometimes go to open meetings with him, so I know that AA lingo you use. And so what we say in these meetings, we don't know how far it's going to go or where it's going to land or how it's going to land. And at the end of it, as a matter of fact, I talked in Sacramento, I guess it was August of 2019, and Joey got to be there at that talk. And I got to introduce her at the end of the talk to the folks there. And she said afterwards, she says, you know, I'm just so sorry, Mike, that it took 47 years for us to get together. And I said, Joey, about 47 years for God to make me worth connecting with. I'm so glad that I didn't drag you through those years of alcoholism. So the story's been a little disjointed tonight, but I want you to know if the miracle hasn't happened for you yet the way you think, or you think they've already all happened, and so what's the point? There's always another miracle to happen. And my choice, am I going to live in Mike's world where he causes pain, breaks the hearts of people he loves, or am I going to live in God's world where I can be useful? So thank you very much for letting me be here with you tonight.
We've come to an end.